I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of May 16th, 2014. Nice to be with you this week. Just ahead, we'll hear about ways to cut out waste in your food budget, also why you're more likely to buy expensive stuff from snooty salespeople, and as always, we'll answer your money questions. But first, we all know we're supposed to check our credit card statements every month to look for fraudulent charges. But we're supposed to do a lot of things. So let's be real. We're going to slip up once in a while. And when we do, what safeguards are in place to catch these sneaky charges? David Lazarus has been looking into this. He's a columnist for the LA Times and a frequent guest host on this program. Welcome back, David.
Thanks, Barbara.
Okay, you just wrote this great column about a California woman who didn't notice she was being billed for something unwarranted on her credit card for 9 years.
Yeah, and that's one story, and it really underlines that we all need to pay close attention to our statements. On the other hand, there are a couple of things that are going on in this case. First of all, the charge that was on her bill kind of was slipped on without her noticing. And the way that happened was back in 2005, she received a check from what looked like Budget Rent-A-Car, thought it was a refund from a recent trip, cashed the check, and didn't know that the fine print on the back of the check enrolled her in a roadside assistance program called AutoVantage, that if she didn't subsequently cancel, she'd be there in perpetuity, and the annual fees topped $100. Now, when she saw that on her credit card statement, it was written all cryptically so that she wasn't quite clear on what it was, assumed it was maintenance done by her husband, and it just slipped by year after year.
Okay, now dial it back. It was a check that looked like a check and wasn't a check. It was more of a promotion.
Well,
is that even legal?
It was a check that was a promotion. So here you go. Here's some money. But if you cash the check, you're now a part of this program. A lot of attorneys general have gotten their knickers in a twist about this. And the company behind it, Affinion Group, which owns AutoVantage, is now barred from doing that because of numerous multi-million dollar settlements over this thing. However, back in the mid-2000s, they were still sending out the checks, and this woman got caught up in it. Now, that's all the backstory for how she got into it, but what really we want to focus on here is the fact that the banks enable this sort of thing. And by that, what I mean is unrelated fraud incidents involving this woman caused the bank, in this case Cap One, to issue new credit card numbers once, twice, maybe even more times. And yet each time she got a new credit card number, the card issuer routinely renewed all the existing recurring payments.
Oh, okay. Now, these are things like, say, Netflix I might have on auto pay or any number of services.
A gym membership, a newspaper subscription.
That's right, which is really a pain if, say, you get a new credit card, right? And then all of your auto pays are canceled? I wouldn't enjoy that as a consumer.
And I hear you, and I understand the rationale for this. Now, Cap One, for its part, says, oh, don't blame us. Blame the big credit card networks like Visa and MasterCard because this is their updater program. And indeed, there is a convenience to consumers in the fact that they are automatically renewing recurring payments. On the other hand, if you're Visa and MasterCard, anytime you are maintaining payments, that's in your interest because that means revenue. So there is a little bit of method to the madness for those guys. And that's why all I'm proposing is every time you get a new credit card number, routinely the card issuer should contact you with a list of your recurring payments and have you simply check the box of the ones that are okay.
Oh, there you go. That would
simple.
Work. Yeah. Now, how common? You mentioned that this charge showed up in a very kind of sneaky, underhanded way, hard to decipher. How common is that?
Well, it's common among the ones that are trying to slip past your attention. So an above-board company like, say, CVS or Stater Brothers or any of these other ones that, in the case of the woman I'm writing about, also she had payments on her credit card statement, well, she saw very clearly who they were. And then there's this other one that's Auto VTG and some numbers, and you can't tell what it is. If it very clearly had said Auto Vantage, this woman would have said, I don't know what that is, and probably 9 years earlier would have taken steps. So is it deliberate? I would say yes.
So first line of defense, do check your credit card statements.
Always.
For anything that you, if you don't know what it is, check up on it, right? But second line of defense, what is the industry's responsibility? And you pointed out that a number of attorneys generals in a number of states picked up on this and prosecuted this company, but the company's still around.
I think what's very important here is that the big companies that we do business with can't be enablers for their more cunning corporate cousins. They need to take our side instead of the side of these other entities with which they probably have some sort of marketing relationship and from which they probably get money. No, if these companies say that they are for their customers and want to protect their customers, as I say, there are very simple safeguards here. Whenever there's a recurring payment and whenever there's a new card, ask us if we want that recurring payment renewed. This can all be automated. This isn't a labor-intensive thing. Not hard, favors the consumer, and suddenly that company, the phone company, the credit card company, is on my side for a change as opposed to being the enemy.
And in terms of advocacy, what can a consumer do? Who can you turn to?
Well, what you need to do is be vigilant. So we talked about looking at your credit card statements routinely, looking at your phone bills routinely. And when you catch these things, you got to contact your card issuer. You got to contact your phone company. You have to be proactive. In almost all cases, they'll do something to protect you. They'll try and get this unwanted charge off of there. But the fact that you have to be the one playing watchdog, as opposed to them being the one playing watchdog for their own bills, the perspective of this is all backwards. And these guys need to turn it around.
David Lazarus with the Los Angeles Times and a friend of Marketplace Money. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Income inequality. It's a big problem here in the U.S., but our friends across the pond are experiencing it at an even more staggering rate. Marketplace Morning Report host David Brancaccio will be broadcasting from the BBC in London all next week, and he's here now to give us a preview of what he'll be up to. Hi, David.
Hey, Barbara.
So what's the occasion for your trip?
We are going to go and broadcast from the nerve center of the BBC in London because London, it can be argued, is the center of the universe these days. And you say, London, isn't that the story from the late 19th century when they were loading up large ships with stuff that was brought in from the colonies and London is old news? London is a fascinating microcosm, I think, these days. We do, as you know, a marketplace. We do a lot of coverage about income inequality, the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Well, you've been to London, right, Barbara?
Absolutely, yes, recently.
All right, so you know what they say in the tube stations, right, especially at Waterloo
Mind
Station with this big
gap.
Curve. Thank you very much. Mind the gap. They don't want you to fall on the tracks. But mind the income gap. It's astonishing what's going on in London. There's so much wealth flowing around. Now, some of it is Middle Eastern. Some of it is from Eastern Europe and Russian oligarchs. London is a fascinating place because if you have business to transact anywhere in the world, there is the rule of law in London. There are lawyers and people who speak the necessary languages, and sort of the apparatus of capitalism is in place in London. Not that it's not in New York, but it's particularly in London these days. So we're going to do a lot of income inequality stories.
So give us an idea. How does income inequality play itself out differently in London or in Great Britain than it does here in the States?
I don't know about different, but actually it's some of the parallels that I think are probably the strongest. London is a place that has become so expensive to live, that the real estate is so astronomically high, that many middle-income people just have to leave, just have to get out of town. Now, this is not completely unfamiliar to people who try to live in Manhattan and have had to find themselves in the hinterlands. But in London, it's really quite striking. Regular folks are finding it increasingly tough to live there. Now, there are some interesting projects in London in which housing projects have been put together that favor people who have jobs in London who may not be paid much for their services, but do jobs that are socially important. For instance, should all the midwives in London live in the hinterlands and not in central London? Should all the firefighters live far away? Well, if you want firefighters and midwives to be living in London, given prices, you have to come up with situations to make that manageable in terms of the personal finances. So there's some really interesting ways that London is trying to address some of this, but many people are finding that London is just too expensive to live in and are going to have to move quite far out.
So the Manhattan effect, a very familiar story.
Indeed.
Now, I know you'll also be examining London's place as the financial center of Europe. So how has London's role in the world economy changed?
I was there in London when it became clear that Britain was not going to adopt the euro like so much of the rest of the European Union. It's going to hold on to its pound. There was a fateful night when the pound was busted out of a special mechanism that was going to align the pound with the European economies and the European currencies. So you'd think that would have forced London onto the periphery of the financial world. Well, the opposite has happened, and so much capital routes itself through London that it really is probably the strongest rival in the world to Wall Street. And we're going to be taking a look at how that plays out.
I know you were telling me about a great story you're looking into about the London sewers. What's that about?
Well, yes, indeed. I'm going to be playing in the sewers to some extent. What's interesting is we have a major debate in the U.S. right now about infrastructure spending. In fact, you saw the administration this last week was arguing that if Congress doesn't fund some of these road projects and other infrastructure projects, 700,000 jobs could be lost. Now, that actual number is up for debate. Well, a similar debate in England, but they're faced with rejuvenating a sewer system that was built during the Victorian era. But what's interesting is this. I was reading up on the history of London sewers. When those were put in, it was the most expensive urban infrastructure project in probably the history of humanity. It was incredibly expensive. But why were they putting in the sewers originally? There were these maps that showed associations between tainted water from the sewers and the water supply and cholera. People were getting desperately ill. So civic-minded people are like, let's put these things in. And guess what happened? Lots of pushback from people who said, we don't want to borrow money for this kind of stuff. We don't think that we have the resources to do an infrastructure project like that. But ultimately, the sewers prevailed. London became the first modern city in that regard. And, of course, the rest of the world ultimately took a while, followed suit. So we'll be talking about the history, but also the present about infrastructure.
Oh, that's fascinating. Can't wait to hear it. Thanks so much for this.
Of course. My pleasure.
David Brancaccio, host of Marketplace Morning Report. David and the Morning Report team will be broadcasting from the BBC London all next week for their Mind the Gap series. You can catch it starting Monday. Coming up, financial expert Jill Schlesinger solves your money dilemmas and helps this caller get her priorities straight.
We both have to borrow heavily for student loans, and we are also, on top of that, contemplating buying a house.
That's just ahead on Marketplace Money from APM. Well, it's time to help out some Marketplace Money listeners with their finances. CBS News senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger joins us now to take calls. And it is so nice to talk with you again, Jill.
Oh, it's great to be with you.
Our first caller is Elizabeth in Austin, Texas. And she is trying to crunch the numbers on debt and career changes, really a whole passel of life decisions. Elizabeth, welcome to the show.
Hi there.
So, lay it out for us. What's your money question?
So, my question is, how much debt is too much debt? My husband and I are, he's an attorney, I'm a wannabe attorney, and we both have to borrow heavily for student loans, and we are also, on top of that, contemplating buying a house.
How's your income right now? What are you pulling in?
Right now, I make around $75,000 a year. My husband makes around $60,000.
And your savings? Where do they stand?
In liquid savings, we have about $30,000. In retirement, we have about $120,000 in a mix of 401k, regular IRA, and Roth IRAs.
Wow, that's great.
That is really good. Yeah, and you're pulling in quite a bit of money. And give us an idea of the debt.
Our existing debt from my husband's degree is about $110,000 at rates between 6.8% and 8.5%. I am contemplating financing my tuition through loans, which is going to be $25,000 a year. And then, if necessary, taking out loans for living expenses, but really trying to avoid that and relying on my husband's income while I'm in school.
Okay. Just one more question before I let Jill loose on you. You mentioned a house. You mentioned law school. What is negotiable for you right now, putting off a law degree or buying the house?
I think buying a house would be the first thing to go. You know, we can always continue to rent, but I'm 30 years old. I've been in my field for 7 years, coming straight out of undergrad. And I know that this isn't what's right for me long term. My plan has always been to go back to law school. It just kind of got delayed a little bit during the recession. But now that my husband's a little more established, I think that's time.
And you're a CPA right now, right?
I am, yes.
Okay. Wow.
Jill, wow, a lot to untangle lot there.
Yes, a lot to chew on. The one thing, it used to be that you go to law school and you know you're going to get a great job out of it. I'm wondering, do you have a, are you going into tax law because you are a CPA or something totally different? Do you have any idea at this point?
Sure. I think tax law is definitely something that would be a natural fit for my abilities, my background and everything. Something definitely in the business law field. I think with my accounting background, my client experience, my corporate experience, I think I should be able to find a job somewhat easier just with those other things on my resume.
I agree. I think really like you would stand out quite a bit. The $110,000 of the outstanding debt that your husband accumulated for school, how are you doing on paying that down? Because, I mean, you make good money, but you don't make crazy money, and that's a big nut. So how are you managing that?
So right now, his loans are in IBR. So our monthly required minimum payment is around $700 a month. We have been paying a little bit extra for that towards our highest interest loans. So we've been paying about $300 a month extra.
And based on that, I presume because you are a CPA, you've crunched the numbers. How long do you think it will take you to pay off the $110,000 in debt?
You know, that's a good question. We have been saving on top of what we're paying towards debt with the idea that having some, you know, cash reserves would probably be more important right now than paying that debt down. So I think for if we paid it off within 10 years, you know, our monthly payment would be about $900 a month. So I think, you know, we're looking to spread that out over a long period of time, probably within 15 to 20 years.
Right.
So, Jill, how I see where you're going. I think how much debt is too much debt?
This may be it right here. because I'm sorry, and I don't mean to dash your hopes of becoming an attorney. I mean, the 110 you're managing, and you could probably pay it off even sooner than 10 years, I think, just sort of given career trajectory and where you guys are and maybe shifting a little bit away from retirement and more towards debt pay down. It would seem to me that that nut you could pay off. And the reason why I'd love for you to pay that off is that those are pretty high interest rates, right? 6.8 to 8.5%. That's a real nut to that you're facing. And certainly it's a, you know, to get a guarantee rate of return of 7 or 8% is pretty awesome. And that's what you're getting when you pay down a student loan quickly. And so my concern is not so much that you can't manage what you have, but if to pile on top of that is going to really put a dent, because now I imagine on one income, if you're in school, you can't make that extra payment. And now you are going to be stuck with this loan for 10 or 15 years. And then it will be harder to get a mortgage when you guys want to do it. So is it possible that you could spread out law school and maybe do something at night or get help from your employer to pay for some tuition reimbursement? Is there any opportunity? I know I hate to dash your dreams. It's just I'm kind of nervous for you financially.
Not really. The program that I have applied to and been accepted to require that you go full time, and they really hold you to working no more than 15 or 20 hours a week. And, you know, on top of that, you know, my career is fairly demanding. I think that I would not really be able to switch to part-time work without taking a significant pay cut. And, you know, if I'm giving up that much money anyway, I think I would rather just throw myself into school full-time and really concentrate on getting good grades so I can get a good job after.
Jill, it sounds like Elizabeth is going with the dream.
She's going with the dream.
You need to solve this problem for her.
Okay, so I'm going to solve the problem. So you're going to take some of the money that you have in Roth. How much is in the, you said 120 grand and a bunch of different things. What is that in Roth? How much of it is Roth money?
About 80,000 is in Roth. I'm sorry, 60,000 is in Roth, and then the rest are pre-tax accounts.
Okay, so I think that you're going to tap some of these accounts to pay for your college, and you're not going to assume any more debt. In fact, I think that the savings that you've done, while it's totally awesome, is probably you're just going to shift it, and instead of delaying the pay down of the debt. Instead of delaying your buying a house, you're also going to delay your retirement a little bit because, I think that you've got this money, you've got this chunk of money that's saved, which is terrific, but I'd rather use what you have already than to assume more debt. So that would be my preference, even though I want you to save for retirement. You're really young, you're 30 years old, you can make that up down the line, and the debt, I think, is going to be harder to pay off.
Elizabeth, I hope that helps you out.
It sure does. Thanks so much.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you. And you're asking all the right questions and you're in a pretty good situation. So best of luck to you. I really think you're on your way.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, let's take one of our emails now. We have a question from Josh. Apparently, he's a longtime listener, first-time emailer, and it looks like all his listening to Marketplace Money has set him up pretty well in his finances. He's just 24 years old, but he's employed. He's managed to save up about $12,000 already at age 24, and he wants to know what he should do with this money. Should he keep it in a savings account for a down payment on a first house? Should he invest it in the market? He's thinking about jumping into the market. And he just asks, where should I begin?
I think there's always like this golden three-step program that I love to encourage young folks to do. So he's 24 years old and he's working and we already know he's a good saver. So step one is that, you have no consumer debt and it doesn't sound like he's got any consumer debt. That's great. And so if you're young and you just get out of school and you say, oh, I'm making money finally, what should I do? Should I save money? Should I pay down my student loan? Should I pay down my credit card debts? Any consumer debt or credit card or an auto loan comes first. Then you start whittling away at the student loan. And the next step is to establish an emergency reserve fund. And you really want 6 to 12 months of your living expenses in a safe place, a savings and a checking, a short-term CD, something that's going to give you really rotten interest, but it's safe and you can access it. And the next step is then you start to put money into your retirement account. And many people will say, well, I've put in up to 6%. That's my match. You don't have to stop at the match. You can put more money in.
And I should say he does. He's putting in 7% into an employee match, and he's currently at 8K and 75% vested.
So this is fantastic. So my guess is that what he should do now is if the $12,000 is his emergency reserve that's in savings, I would probably knock my 401k contribution, put, say, 10% in, and then I would start to make sure that I understand what are my next steps. Do I really want to buy a house? I mean, you can be 24 years old. You don't buy a house for the sake of buying a house. Do you want to put roots down where you are? That can be great. It's awesome, but it's also limiting. What if you get a fantastic job and it's three states away? So you've got to really think about whether renting is preferable to you at this stage in your life.
Well, we're going to take a short break now, and then we'll be back. Jill, can you hang around with us?
I would love to.
We have another call from Greg in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Greg, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks a lot.
I understand you have a baby on the way. Congratulations.
Yes, we do. Yeah, the baby's coming in August.
Oh, well, I already hear a little bit of apprehension in your voice.
Oh, yeah. But we're excited and happy that's coming along. So,
well, what's on your mind besides the excitement and perhaps a little terror?
Sure. Previously, I had felt we had a good financial plan for the two of us going on. And then with the baby coming along, I had some questions about both between college savings and the potential of increasing life insurance.
What do you do there in Milwaukee?
Sure. I'm a design engineer at a medical device company.
Okay. And how much do you make?
I make about $85,000. My wife works at a university in student administration, and she makes about $43,000 a year.
Okay. And how about your retirement accounts? How are you doing there?
I personally think we're doing pretty good. We're both 29. We've got about $73,000 saved up so far.
Wow.
So I feel fairly confident in that based off of all your guys' past advice and recommendations. We both do have our 401k and 403b matches going on with our companies, and those are maxed out. So we feel like we're in a pretty good spot, and in the next month or so, I'll also be eligible for my pension with my company.
Okay, well, great. So looking ahead to August and beyond, what is the best way to be financially responsible to a new child? Jill?
So you mentioned, I think, that the big issue here is around life insurance. What kind of coverage do you have right now first through either your employer or privately?
Yeah, so the only life insurance coverage that I personally have right now is just through my employer. It covers both normal life, any death occurrences, and accidental.
But don't you always love that concept? Like, we'll pay you more or less if it's an accident. You're like, well, but I'm dead. Can't you just pay me the same no matter what? Okay, let's. How yeah. much is the coverage?
Yeah, accidental is just my yearly salary. And if it's any other circumstances based off of what I could read from my benefits, that would be 2.5 times my salary.
Okay, so and how about what's the game plan when you have the baby? Are you guys staying home? Is one staying home? What's the who's doing what, and what's the work life going to be like after?
Work life is going to be plenty busy. My wife will be going back to work, so the baby will be going to daycare 3 or 4 days a week. Her mom has volunteered to be a babysitter 1 day a week. So
that's the best.
Oh, that's great.
So I think that what you probably want to do is you're going to need to get some supplemental life insurance for both of you, right? Because you make such a nice combined income now that the loss for either income is going to have a significant impact on the family circumstances. And so the first thing you want to do is you want to figure out, how much do I need? And actually, there's a very cool calculator that you might want to check out. It's called lifehappens.org. lifehappens.org, and you can basically plug in a lot of different variables. Well, you know, gee, I'm going to have an awesome funeral. It's going to cost this much. This is what I want to pay for my kids' college education. This is what my income is. This is what I want to contribute going forward to, you know, my wife's retirement. And you plug in all these variables, and then poof, a number is going to come out. And a lot of it will have to do with, you know, whether you guys want to try to fund college education. If one of you were to die, would you want to, like, sort of pre-fund the lump sum necessary to get your kid through college? Obviously, that would add to your life insurance needs. And you'll come up with some number, and I'm just going to throw a number out there. Let's say it's $1 million. And says, okay, you need $1 million. And what I would go out and do is I would go find myself a nice term life insurance policy. A term is just means you keep it for a specific period of time, a term under which your family is at risk. And in your case, it would be the amount of time that your kid was sort of young and growing up, where the loss of that income would have such a significant impact. And so it's probably going to be something like a 20-year term life insurance policy for $1 million. It's super cheap because you're young and you're probably healthy, and you each should get a policy that would cover each of you, because, again, even though you make more than she does, if something bad happened to her, God forbid, you'd probably kind of pull back on the amount of work you'd be doing, or you'd need more care. So you'd need both of you guys to have insurance policies that cover your family's needs. And again, I really do recommend term life. Someone's going to try to sell you whole life or universal life or some other insurance which has an investment component. I'd run from the hills from that. I would just get term.
Okay, that's great advice.
I noticed, Greg, you did mention 529 plans earlier in the conversation. Jill, you haven't gone back to that. Is that something that you should wait on as a parent?
Well, first of all, you always have to wait because we need a social security number. So we must wait until August at the very least. So I think 529 plans are fantastic, presuming that both you and your wife are maxing your retirement accounts, meaning maxing not to the match, but maxing your total contribution. I'd rather you max out retirement first, then start using 529 plans. For two reasons. One is that, you know, college savings, you can start, you know, a couple years down the line. I'd rather you guys have that nice pile of money in that base in your retirement accounts and then use the 529 plan. But, you know, realistically, there's no loan program for retirement. There are some things called student loans for college. And so it's more important that I would have you max out retirement before we start 529s, although I love 529 plans.
Thanks so much for this call. That was really informative. I really appreciate it, Greg.
Yeah, no worries. Thanks a lot for all the information.
And I wish you the best with becoming a father.
Thank you very much.
Okay, take care. Jill Schlesinger is a senior business analyst for CBS News, and it is always a pleasure. Thank you so much for this.
It was so great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Just ahead, have you ever been snubbed at a high-end store? What'd you do, walk out or complain? Or did the salesperson's snobby attitude make you want to buy something?
When you come into a store and the salespeople just gives you a dirty look or they ignore you, essentially make you feel like maybe you're not in the right store. In those situations, if you as a consumer really want that brand, that's kind of just a challenge, I think, is the way people looked at it and said, hey, I can't afford that, and I'm going to show you.
The Devil Sells Prada, that's next on Marketplace Money from APM. When Groucho Marx famously said, "I don't want to belong to any club that will accept me as a member," he could have been talking about our next story. A new study shows that consumers are more likely to buy luxury goods from a rude or snooty salesperson. Darren Dow co-authored the research. He's a professor of marketing and behavioral science at the University of British Columbia's Sauder School of Business. And thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay, first off, I pictured you scouring the country looking for snobby salespeople. How did you conduct this study?
Well, the study was done in an experimental context, and we did it in two different ways. One of the approaches we did was actually a scenario where we put people in a scenario. We gave them a written description of what it would be like, and then we assessed their response. The other way that we did it was we actually had people interact with real salespeople and then assessed how they reacted in more of a real-world context.
Okay, and were your participants avowed consumers of luxury goods?
Well, that's what's interesting about this study is that the effects that we found really only work. So in other words, you respond positive to snobby salespeople. It only really works if you aspire to the brand. So if it's something that you want and you don't have. So for those consumers that are regular luxury shoppers, this effect doesn't happen. It's only for individuals that don't have those brands that really, really want them.
Was there a line over which a salesperson could not go?
Well, I mean, we didn't test how far, you know, you could go on that. The manipulations that we used were mainly just rude behavior and condescending behavior. And so kind of that experience that I think many of us have had when you come into a store and the salespeople just gives you a dirty look or they ignore you or they essentially make you feel like, you know, maybe you're not in the right store. In those situations, if you as a consumer, you know, really want that brand, that's kind of just a challenge, I think, is the way people looked at it and said, you know, hey, I can't afford that, and I'm going to show you. And that's what happens, is they actually respond positively because, you know, they want to prove that they do belong in the club.
Well, did this hold true in every case for every salesperson with every form of rudeness?
Where it doesn't show up, interestingly, is for brands that aren't aspirational. So we tried it with brands like The Gap and American Eagle and these types of brands, and it doesn't happen because most consumers can afford these types of brands. So poor service doesn't win you any friends in those types of contexts. It also doesn't happen if the salesperson doesn't match the brand. And so if it's someone selling Prada or Burberry and they don't look like they're, you know, should be there themselves, you don't get that effect. You only react if it's someone that, you know, truly represents the brand.
Well, and you found that this snob effect fades after time, too. How do you account for that?
So what's interesting is it kind of is like a boomerang effect, that in the moment, right, you react and take the challenge and you say, okay, I'm going to buy that product. But after you go home, right, and you've, you know, been thinking about the experience for maybe a week or so, because we went back and talked to people 2 weeks later, it actually turns out that you actually dislike the brand and the experience much more than the average person. So it essentially a boomerang.
I do come away from this kind of depressed and thinking less of humanity. I mean, how about you? What do we take away from this?
I think it shows that, you know, we as consumers are social animals, and we want to belong to clubs, which you started the show with the Groucho Marx quote. And, you know, things that we really want and that we aspire to, if someone, just like when we were in high school, says, you know, I'm not sure you can belong to this group, you know, you may work a little harder to get there. And whether that's good or bad, I mean, that's tough to say. The research shows that, you know, we do react in the moment, and sometimes, you know, it's surprising.
And so in terms of retailers, should they look at this and say, well, I should have a good cop, bad cop kind of situation in my store, someone who looks really snobby and represents the brand and is a little bit rude, and someone else who can kind of ease along a sale?
If you're a luxury brand, you want to create an air of elite and luxury and exclusion. I mean, that's part of these brands is, you know, they're for the upper class, if you will. And so that kind of creates an attitude that can be very dangerous because it can be perceived to be rude. And sometimes, obviously, the salespeople, I think everyone has a story, salespeople go overboard. But overall, I mean, it's never good practice to be rude to customers if you're the retailer.
What made you want to look into this?
Personal story. I was actually the victim of this whole phenomenon. I was really excited about a new Hermes cologne, actually. They have this grapefruit cologne. It's really great. And I had gone into the store in downtown Vancouver here where I live, and I had just been wearing a T-shirt and some torn jeans, and the salesperson looked up when I walked in and shook her head at me. And I was kind of like, hey, come on. And I was like, that's not cool. And I thought, you know what? I can afford that, and I actually ended up buying two bottles of the cologne. And as I was leaving, I was like, why the heck did that happen? Like, that was really bad service, but I still bought. So I wanted to understand, you know, why did I react that way?
The pretty woman effect. You fell prey.
It's a pretty woman effect, yes.
Darren Dell is a professor of marketing and behavioral science at the University of British Columbia's Sauder School of Business, and apparently he likes the smell of grapefruit. Thanks so much for this.
You betcha.
Well, summer's almost here, the traditional season of the internship. If you're a high school or college student and you haven't lined one up yet, yikes, you better get on the stick. But interns of every stripe, beware. In the last few years, a series of lawsuits against employers offering unpaid internships have changed the rules of the apprenticeship game. Rachel Feinzig is a management reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
As I was just saying, a number of these high-profile lawsuits have worked their way through the courts in recent years. What new laws are on the books concerning unpaid internships now?
There's new legislation in a variety of areas, from California to New York, kind of extending employment discrimination laws to interns. But I think the biggest change that we've seen has really been from the employer side and the university side. We're seeing universities put into place more protections for interns, kind of screening out what postings they'll, you know, field to students. And we're seeing employers kind of change their own programs.
Yeah, and how are they changing their programs? I know, for instance, in the media, at least a number of companies like Condé Nast no longer offer any internship programs at all.
Yeah, that's been the biggest change. We talk to employment lawyers who are seeing companies just kind of do away with these programs altogether. They're proceeding very cautiously. Sometimes they are transforming to a paid program. Viacom just did that after facing a lawsuit from some former MTV interns. You know, if they do move to a paid internship program, a lot of times they end up being smaller.
So more competition for fewer places, it sounds like.
Exactly. Yeah. We're hearing that, you know, the internships that are still out there are kind of more bulked up as these new laws and lawsuits scare employers, but there's just maybe not as many of them out there.
And if the companies do offer unpaid internships, how are they changing them to meet the new guidelines?
I mean, I think they're just being very, very cautious and really taking a look more than they did before as to, you know, the Labor Standards Act. It says that unpaid interns, they can't be replacing work that would normally be done by employees. There has to be an educational benefit. This can't just be a benefit for the company. So I think they're really treading lightly here.
So what are unpaid interns not allowed to do anymore? For instance, the time-honored Starbucks run. Is that still in the game?
They just can't do anything that a paid employee could, you know, is part of their job. So, I mean, at Condé Nast, we saw people suing because they said they were paid less than an hour for tasks like proofreading documents or organizing jewelry. If it's something that someone else is being paid to do, then, I mean, legally, you're supposed to pay the intern to do it. It kind of goes back to those guidelines I was talking about before, where there has to be that direct educational benefit. They can't be displacing other employees.
So why would companies offer that? What's in it for them?
Relationships with the community and the university, you know, kind of bringing the next generation into their industry. There isn't supposed to be a benefit for the employer for an unpaid internship.
You mentioned, though, that colleges are changing their policies about how to support students in finding internships. So what are they doing?
Yes, we've seen a bunch of changes on that front recently. Columbia no longer gives this special internship credit on students' transcripts. NYU makes employers check a box certifying that they're complying, you know, with all the labor laws out there. And Hamilton College won't post an unpaid internship from a company that also offers paid internships.
You know, as a parent, I don't really know how to think about this. I've had my kids do internships, and it's a fantastic opportunity, and they learn real skills. But it sounds as if with these new guidelines, they won't have that opportunity.
You know, it's really tough. It's a tough job market out there, especially for young people, and they need a way to stand out. At the same time, there's data out there that shows that having an unpaid internship doesn't necessarily make you more likely to get a job than not having an internship at all. So the data shows that really there's only a connection between a paid internship in terms of getting a job offer. It can be helpful in terms of kind of just seeing what it's like to be in the corporate world, seeing if this is a career or an industry you might want to go into. I think there is still value there.
I remember my internship. It ruled out for me the whole field of electron microscopy.
I probably could have told you that before you had your
internship. Yeah, no surprises there. Rachel Feinsig reports on management for The Wall Street Journal. It was great talking to you. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you so much.
You've divvied up your income between rent, mortgage, car payments, and other big-ticket items. What's the biggest expense in your budget? If you're like most Americans, it's food. Whether it's restaurants or rotisserie chickens, a lot of money can disappear into your mouth before you even know it. Kristen Wong is a personal finance writer with the Lifehacker blog 2 Cents, and she's here to give us some ideas about how to get our food spending under control. Kristen, it's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, so before we get to the tips and the strategies, is food such a big budget leak for most people? Because the research shows that Americans spend a smaller percentage of their income on food than ever before.
Yeah, I think it's still a really big expense, and it's just one of those expenses that varies so much. So you can do a lot about it. You can there's a lot you can do to kind of lower that cost, but it's a necessity, so it's kind of one of those things you just can't get around.
let's start with the basics then. What staple foods should we build our recipes around to get the most out of our food dollars?
So there are food staples that I know are healthy and that cost effective, and you can kind of use them in a lot of different recipes. Lentils are really good. Sweet potatoes, potatoes. If you're a fan of tofu, not everybody has the palate for tofu, but if you do, it's a really good cost-effective way that you can eat.
Yeah, and I'm thinking that traditionally casseroles have always been thought of as the best value recipe, but they can be kind of fattening. A lot of people are concerned about weight and issues like that. So do you have ideas? Is that no longer the way to go, to think in terms of casseroles?
Personally, I don't really do a lot of casseroles. Maybe if I get kind of lazy at the end of the week and I have a bunch of leftover stuff, I'll just put something tasty together with some like starches and potatoes. I think a lot of people think it's difficult and expensive to eat healthy, but I don't, at least in my own experience, I don't find that it's that much more expensive to eat a healthy diet. You can get a lot of produce that's on sale and in season, and you can freeze it and use it later on when it's not in season. You know, and then just something as simple as like chicken breast or chicken thighs with cheap side vegetable that happens to be in season and on sale is good.
Okay, let's talk some procedural tips. Should you plan out a whole week's worth of meals?
I think ideally, you should. Not everybody has time for that. What a lot of people do, and we wrote about this strategy called the inverted pyramid method, is they'll plan out like one or two really big meals, and then they'll kind of plan the rest of their meals during the week based on the leftover ingredients from the one or two big meals. So I think that's kind of a cool strategy because you're avoiding food waste, which is what this all boils down to, is like that's the main thing you don't want to do is when you're on a budget, you want to use all the stuff that you're buying. So if you can just plan out your biggest meal and then kind of work your way down and plan a meal, say, you know, look at that big meal and say, okay, what ingredients am I going to have left over from that? What can I make with those ingredients? And then just plan down to the week until you finally get to your last meal, which is just kind of a hodgepodge of what's left over from all those other meals.
This was my next question. I have a cabinet full of odds and ends left over from other recipes. Like, you know, how do I use up random half bags of flax meal and pumpkin puree and things like that? So that would be a way to subvert it. But are there, for instance, apps that help you clean out your cabinet and get rid of that kind of waste?
Yeah, one of my favorite websites to use for meal planning is a website called Supercook, and you can put in whatever you have in your pantry and it will just automatically compile recipes for you. And you can even highlight like the ingredient that you want to focus on. So if you have extra, let's say tofu, you can highlight that and then all these recipes will pop up with tofu as the main ingredient. So yeah, that's one. I know a lot of our Life Hackers readers, they like a app called Ziplist. Pepperplate is another free one. And then our readers also liked CookSmarts, which I think is a subscribe one. But these apps basically help you keep track of what's in your pantry and compile grocery lists for you based on what kind of recipes you want to make for the week. So you can look up recipes on the app and then compare them to what you have in your home and then see what you need to get to the grocery store.
So you can get the most out of every ingredient you've ever bought.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I'd like you to run down some myths, and maybe they're not myths, buying in bulk. Will that save you money? And are big box stores the way to go? Because I understand you can also waste a lot of money. Certainly I have in the big box stores.
Yeah. I don't usually shop at the big box stores just because we're a two-person household. I think it's better for families. But if you're going to, there are some things that just people don't realize expire. Like I read the other day that laundry detergent actually can expire and lose its efficacy over time.
No, get out. No, don't tell me that.
So it might not be worth buying it in bulk if you're not going to use it for, you know, a few years or I don't know how long it takes, how long you stockpile that stuff. But it's almost like an investment when you buy all these items in bulk. So to think about when you're going to use it and if you're going to use it, because it would be a shame to buy all that stuff and let it go to waste.
Okay, while we're talking and I'm airing all my dirty laundry, I don't use coupons either. I just can't get around that. And also, I don't tend to buy the things that there are coupons for. So am I going to die in the poorhouse?
No.
Because of this?
Most people actually give me a hard time for using coupons. It's not for everybody, but there are plenty of other ways you can save money if you're not into that. There's an app called Checkout 51 that I just downloaded and I'm kind of excited about, where you can just go to the grocery store and scan your receipt, and then it gives you like rebates, 50 cents here, a dollar here on everyday items like milk or avocados or something. And you just scan your receipt and they'll send you a rebate check once you hit like $20 or something like that. So if you want to like boost your savings. I think there are certainly ways you can do it aside from couponing. But even if you don't, I think the most where you're going to save the most money is just making the most out of the money that you do have to spend on food and not and avoiding waste is what I think it's really all about.
Kristen Wong, she writes about personal finance for TwoCentsLifeHacker.com. Thank you so much. So much useful information.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Lizzie O'Leary is in the lab working on creating our new show, Marketplace Weekend. So keep an ear out for that on the weekend of June 28th. Marketplace Money is produced by Caitlin Funaro and Candace Manriquez with additional help from Lindsay Foster Thomas. Our senior producer is Dan Simatovich. Chris Clark is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Barbara Bogave, and remember, always check with your financial professional before you make any big money decisions. Thanks for listening, and see you next week. This is APM.